You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
Now, there are people who write books, many of them. But then there are those who write worlds. And my guest tonight, Nick Mhlongo, is one such person. Worlds where Soweto street corners speak in rhythms, where grief sits at the kitchen table, and where joy crashes through the door uninvited. His sentences have the pace of a taxi speeding down Old Potch, the humor of a corner barber, and the weight of stories passed from elder to child in dimly lit rooms. Since the day Dog Eat Dog hit the shelves, Nick has been less of an author and more of a cartographer, mapping the heartbreak and hilarity of South Africa with the precision of someone who has lived every line. He's given us After Tears, Way Back Home, Soweto Under the Apricot Tree, and anthologies that hold the pulse of our people like a stethoscope. To read Nick is to walk through the city barefoot, feeling every stone, every warmth, every scar. And right now, we get to walk with the man himself. Mr. Nick Mhlongo, hello.
Thank you so much, Mpumi. Hello to you, and thank you so much for the beautiful introduction.
Oh, it's only a pleasure, and all of it is true, so I could say it confidently. Now, Mhlongo, tell us, when you look back at your earliest memories, what were the first stories that you encountered, and how did they shape the writer that you became?
Thank you so much for that question. So I grew up in a home full of books. My brothers, I was lucky to have brothers that were readers. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, most of 80% of the books that I read were the books that were written by African writers. To be specific, there was African writers series. Mm-hmm. So in my home, we'll be reading great Ngugi wa Thiong'o, great Achebe, Buchi Emecheta, Ellen Kuzwayo, you name them. There are quite some number of them. So yeah. I grew up reading those, actually. Mm. And on top of that, I mean, when I had to go internationally, I used to love too much of also James Hadley Chase. And then, quite a number of books. But there were, of course, books that I didn't understand, that I didn't like, that were prescribed in school.
Yeah.
And I'm not afraid to say I was not a great fan of Shakespeare because I didn't understand anything.
Okay, but I get it. That English.
I didn't understand anything.
Yes.
So, but when I had to touch African writer series books, they talked about me. They talked about a boy herding cattle. These are the things that I knew, And then, so they talked about eating pap. They didn't talk about daisies, daffodils, and whatever. That things that I could imagine.
Yes.
So that's how I fell in love with African literature. And I think one of my favorite authors, for instance, was books. Mm. Was Down Second Avenue by Eskom Pahlele.
Yeah.
And then I also loved, it transported me into, Pretoria by then. Mm. I also loved Marabi Dance, for instance. It was so good, to read about the past and compare it to the present. So that's the environment in which I grew up in.
So it sounds to me like what informed your writing then, or the writer you became, is that you wanted people to see themselves in your literature, just like you gravitated towards the books that highlighted and showed you in print.
Yes, that's exactly like that.
Yeah.
Because you just introduced my work so nicely and beautifully. because I'm a realist writer. So that's why I, when I talk or when I read particular characters, I would love to, bring my mind into it. Like,
yes.
as I say, reading is like creating your own theater of mind.
Yeah.
So if you have a theater of mind, the good way of creating it is to live the way people live, or pretend to live the way people live, and write exactly the dialogue of that particular time, and talk about things that people know, so that when people say, "Oh, there's Uncle Nyawana in Uncle in Nick's book," who is always asking for 2 rand on the street of Soweto.
Yes.
So you, every one of us have Uncle Nyawana there. You know, when I talk about now, I talk about the, I write the story about people that are, you know, abusing drugs, for instance, on the parks, in whether in Meadowlands or whatever, you know, everyone can associate themselves with these stories. This one particular person, you know, the people closer to you that you know, so those are the kind of, that's how I'm a realist writer.
It is incredibly funny that you say that, because 2 days ago on Sunday, I found out that a giant of a man who did incredible work in the world, in the Christian world particularly, passed away. And I remember there was a time when life had knocked him down and he would go around asking for 2 rand. So when you said 2 rand, I was like, there is absolutely no way, because this is a real story. And I know Uncle Nyawana, in this case, it was a pastor who would also go around asking for 2 rand.
Yes, exactly.
Those
are the kind of stories that we do, actually. We reflect reality. Yeah.
Dog Eat Dog. We have to talk about this book because it puts you on the map in a huge way. You know what I'm curious about? What is the story behind this first book, both in how it came to you and what it took to actually say, all right, I'm releasing this to the world?
I think a couple of things that happened, you know, when I was writing this book. Firstly, is the book that I wrote actually when I was in at the University of Cape Town, and trying to reflect on my life and my struggles at the university.
Yes.
But all in all, this book talks about the challenges that young black South Africans who are first at the university and first in their families to go to the university, are suffering from, are not getting, the challenges that they meet at the university itself. So I decided to write that so that people, younger generations, and know what to expect when they go to the university.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, there are too many cultural clashes when you go to the university for the first time. Because I went to university at a really great critical time, transitional time in South Africa in 1994. And around that time, what happened was that we were just happy to find ourselves in the university.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that we found that, the challenge that we got while being there is that you come from a respective family.
Yeah.
And then for the first time, you're taught by a white person.
Yes.
And then you are told, not to call him by the surname.
Imagine,
you cannot call him Professor
or Baba or Mama.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Yes.
And then for the first time, and once you do that, it means that you are done. Is to us, once you call somebody by a name who is older than you, is a sign of disrespect. So you are forgotten. You call somebody Christopher, for instance, and then all of a sudden it doesn't feel right.
Yes.
And that person doesn't understand that you are coming from a different culture.
Yeah.
And also one of the things that we wanted to highlight, just to give you an example, I grew up in the township, for instance, whereby, everyone around you is a mother.
Mm-hmm.
or if somebody's same age as your mother, you call them mother. Same age as your sister is your sister. Same age as your brother is brother. So it means that when you go to a white, formerly white only institution now, and then you ask, for instance, for you didn't do some work, and you say, ah, I was at the funeral of my mother. It, to them, it sounded like, to other people, it sounded like, oh, your mother died so many times. Because the following week, you'll go
it's
again.
It's your mother again.
It's your mother as well. So you end up being a liar, you know, to... so I really wanted to show that as South Africans, there was a need for us to talk to each other and understand each other, where we come from culturally.
Oh, so good. Now, you've written novels, short stories. You've even edited anthologies. I'd like to know, how do you decide what form a story should take?
I would say a short story, it's a trial and error kind of a thing, you know? Yes, it's not necessarily, specifically for me, it's a trial and error. At that particular time when I need to write lots of short story, I focus myself, I immerse myself with the reading of lots of short stories from all over the world, you know, and try to find out, this is the kind of story that I would like to write. Like, for instance, I want to write something that has got drama. I want to write something about death. So firstly, what I do, I will select a kind of a theme. And a theme could be, you know, be informed by something that presses me a lot. You know, maybe it can be a theme about ghosts, you know. So I will read something like, for instance, Metamorphosis. I'm just making an example by Franz Kafka. By Franz Kafka, and come back to it so many times. I want to write something about gender-based violence, for instance. I would write, I'll read something that is related to that. You know, corruption. I'll read something that is related to that. But when you sit down and write now, you are, I'm guided, for instance, by that particular theme. But how it comes out, it doesn't mean that when I'm writing, I cannot change certain things. So the story might come out as if it's a very interesting crime story, only to find that it changes into something else. So depending on the emphasis of the particular characters and whatever, you know, if I want to be it to be character driven or theme driven. So for me specifically, it's trial and error. And then when I, after writing it, like, for instance, I come back to it so many times. By the time you read it, I might have changed it maybe more than 20 times. You know? And then normally, how does it, how do I tell myself that this story now is well, is nicely written? In most cases, I give to a bunch of readers, you know, and then these are the people that read for me and say, ah, this story lacks A, B, C, and D. Add a particular character, you know, such kind of things. That's how I do it, actually. But of course, there are different ways. We all employ different ways of how to write. But with me is that firstly, I identify a theme. And then I say to myself, this is the theme I want to write about, you know. Like, for instance, I'll give you an example. I wrote this a collection called... For You, I'd Steal a Goat. One of the first short stories there is about, you know, inspired by things that happened in the township old houses. That you walk around the township in most cases, you'll find that there's a family squabble about inheriting a particular family house. And then you'll find that one brother, for instance, is selling your house, a sister is saying no, and then to such an extent that you walk around and then the
wall is the written house, not for sale.
Exactly. So that's exactly how I wrote this short story. I was going, I think around Snawan and stuff in Soweto and Snawan, There was a wall thing not for sale, and the grass had overgrown in the yard.
Yes.
And the windows are broken. So behind that, to me, it gave me a very sense of a story. What's the story behind the broken windows? What's the story behind
the overgrown grass?
You know, so somebody, it means that family is fighting.
Yes.
So let me create a story out of it.
Yes.
And make the new story altogether out of it. Yeah.
You know, black people have been rumored to not be much of readers, you know, and Soweto filled with black people, and the stories that you are writing are our stories. Do you find it, do you find that your writing actually meets its recipients, as in the books that you read, do they have an audience that is, that are the people who live and can relate to these stories, or do you find more sales for your books going to people who are curious about the culture and the life that we have become so accustomed to that we don't necessarily feel like we need to read in a book?
I will say this. The notion that black people don't read is a myth.
And that's why I said it's been rumored, because I'm a black person and I read. You're a black person and you write.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I'll give you an example. I wrote Doggy Dog and then published in 2004. And then at some, you know, they give you author's copies. No. At some point, somebody came, a neighbor, and borrowed it. That's 2004. Borrowed it. And then after 2 weeks, I wanted to fetch my book. They said it's next door. I went to next door. It's at the corner over there. So one book can circulate. Circulate. It can be touched by thousands of hands. You know. So perhaps one thing that we can say is that the culture.
Yeah.
Of buying a book is not yet developed, but the culture of reading is there.
Is there?
So the culture of taking my money and buying a book is not there from the poor people, you know. And you understand because of the economic disparities and stuff. Somebody who's earning 350. Child grant, it's very difficult to expect such kind of a person to go and buy book.
Even if that book could give them an idea that could change their finances completely.
Exactly. Because books are like medicine.
Yeah.
I mean, they're therapeutic and they're cathartic. So that's the culture. But I'm just want to say that black people do buy books.
Yeah.
They do read books, and then to qualify this, I'll say majority, 90% or 95% of people that read books are women in South Africa.
This is true, young women. Actually.
Yes, because if you look into book clubs in South Africa, we've got more than 1,000 of book clubs. Majority of those book clubs are, you know, run by women. And we see them every time attending book festivals, book launches, and buying books. So we really want to say big up to book clubs. Hopefully our male counterparts will read. So women read a lot of fiction. And then when you get to guys, they pretend to be reading a non-fiction.
Yes.
You know, something that about how the economy works and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, such kind of things. But with women, they read, their overall readers.
Yeah.
So that's why they are 95% of South African readers, not only South Africa,
all over the world,
is women. Yeah.
And how does this data then inform the kind of stories that you write and the marketing of your books? Because I know for a fact that how you market to men is different to how you market to women, and not because of anything other than the language and the things that concern us vary. So how does the information that you now know about 95% of readers being female or women change what you write, how you market it, and how you then sustain your business?
Yeah, I'll say it changes marketing, but how you write is very difficult. You don't write for a particular audience.
That's interesting.
You know, you don't write to people. When you write, firstly, you write because you got something to say, that it's on your chest and you wanted to get it out there. You don't look into, you don't look into
who's going to
who
be
do
reading.
I write for.
Yes.
That one, you only do it when you are commissioned, for instance, by a magazine or whatever to write a story about women or whatever. You are commissioned. But when you commission yourself, you write about things that are very much important to you. And stories don't have gender in that particular way.
All they are is truth.
But they are just the truth, and they are just stories that everyone should consume.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that our male counterparts, you know, we don't read, or we are naturally, okay, I'll just say this, naturally not readers.
Yes.
I can say this because I've been to different or many, you know, literary festivals around the world. It's the same trend, the same trend everywhere, you know. So, but how do I change the marketing? So I'm one of those people that used to that use book clubs a lot. That's why I love book clubs. You know, I love book clubs. I've been, when I'm invited by a book club to come and do my and read my work, that makes me happy. You know why it makes me happy?
Yeah.
Is because almost everyone in that book club, even if there are six people, they would have read your work.
Yes.
So in a festival, you'll have a festival that is being attended by 1,000 people, but only three people read your work, or they've just seen you for the first time. So book clubs, for instance, are the ones that I specifically go to. You know, I've been invited to by the ones in Ghana. I've been invited by the ones in Kenya, in Zimbabwe. Yeah, so I've been, I'm closer to many books, clubs, you know. So that is this marketing strategy that I have. Another thing that I have is to put a book on the hand of people, or into people's hands. Why I'm saying, what I'm saying by this is that I'm one of the few people that while I was still living in South Africa, I would drive around and then sell books from the boot of my car, you know. So I will target places, Chisanyamas. I will target, for instance, you know, clubs. And then I park my car. I always travel with a book. Oh, and then somebody say, oh, I've got a book for you. And then I sign it. People love such kind of a thing. Imagine, I'm just imagining, that's the, one of the things that I do as well. You know, when I go to festivals, one of the things that I also like going to book festival is that this is the only place, or book launches, is the only place that you get a book autographed. You know, imagine yourself doing that for a period of 20 years.
Yes.
How many books that are autographed are in your house? I have Chimamanda's autographed book. Now it's difficult for you to get a Chimamanda to autograph a book because she's so popular, you know. And you know, but I have that. I have people that have unfortunately passed away who have autographed my book. So for me, that's a treasure. You know, that's why my library in Soweto, it's always like getting in there. I always check. I don't care about whether anything can be stolen or whatever. I look into the shelves. I know that this book is missing. This book is missing. Because they're autographs. They're my treasure.
Yes.
So that's what I do. That's what I do. So in a nutshell, well, when you write, you write. I don't know, maybe there are people that write for the audience. I don't write for the audience. I write because I've got a story to tell. And then a story doesn't change simply because now I want to target this group.
Yes.
No, it doesn't, you know. And then also when I want to market, that's how I market the book. That's why you become an ambassador of your books.
Yes.
In that way. Yeah.
It's something you believe. You're not just trying to sell a story. You're telling a story.
Yeah. Exactly.
I know you've mentored and inspired many emerging writers, and I'd love for you in this moment to give advice to those who are trying to find their voice. You know, you've just said, write what is in your heart, write what is in your mind, write what you really, truly, deeply believe and are convicted of. And how can people find their voice enough to then start penning it and putting it out into the world?
I will answer it in this way. There are so many people that believe that, I also used to believe that, you know, that wanting to be a writer, I firstly have to write like my favorite writers.
Yes.
Sorry. You know, I used to love a lot, and I still love Eskom Pahlele. That's why I mentioned Eskom Pahlele, and that Eskom Pahlele, I mentioned him down Second River Road, down Second Avenue. So I used to love that book to such an extent that I realized that I cannot be like him. I can only be like him by being a writer, but I cannot write the beautiful English like he does, you know? Writing, for instance, that gave me an idea that writing is not about going to, many people think like you have to go to attend, MFA, you know, that is not it.
Yeah.
Writing is practice. So if you keep writing and keep practicing it, you'll get it right at some point.
That is true.
There are failures, you know, along the way.
Yeah.
And even myself now, I'm still practicing to write the way I would love to
write.
All
these years later.
So you always keep on practicing. You always keep on practicing. How do you get it right? You get it right when you now have when you have confidence. You can only get confidence by reading a lot.
This is true.
So if you read and read quite a lot, sometimes you think like, I can tell this story better. You know?
Yeah.
I can tell it because there's no story in the world that is unique. That story that we want to tell has been told by somebody else. But in a different way, you know. So, but if you keep on, you tell yourself, I want to tell this story in the way that I think is right, or I'll be doing justice to this kind of a story. That is very beautiful. Like, for instance, I'll tell you the story that I've attempted to write so many times, and I've heard about it so many times. It's a story of Vera the Ghost. Who owns it?
Nobody knows.
No one owns it. Okay. So no one has told it in the way that I would have loved. I would love to read it. So I have to write it. I have to write it myself. That's the story I'm busy writing at the moment. You know, and I'm not saying that I'll get it right.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that I will have confidence of writing it because I've done so much research about it. I've had people talk about it so many times, and then now I feel it's my right time to tell it, you know. So I'm just, that's just an example, actually.
Yes.
I knew I've written something like that before. So read a lot. That's my advice. Read a lot.
Yeah.
Read a lot. And in the, while you're reading, write a lot.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
And then share your work with different people.
You know, the advice you're sharing is actually so transcendent across multiple disciplines, because I'm a speaker. And what you've just said is the way to find your voice is to use it.
Yeah.
Because if you don't use it, you don't know how it sounds. You don't know how people react when you say certain things. And it's only when you use your voice that you begin to find it. And you said something about reading and writing. And I find that I need to read as well so that I'm informed. But I also need to listen to other speakers. And in that, I don't think there's also a risk of sounding like other people. Because what happens is, if you listen to someone long enough, you almost start to sound like them. I think that is inevitable. If you hang around somebody long enough, you start to laugh like them. You start to behave like them. But what happens is, when you do that, something in you doesn't feel right because it's inauthentic to you. So even as a speaker, if I try and stand up and try to sound like Vusi Thembekwayo, I'm going to be like, Before anybody cringes, I'm cringing already because it just doesn't feel right. So I love what you're saying about use the tool you're trying to find to see what it sounds
exactly.
like and whether or not you actually like what you are saying and how people are resonating with it. I absolutely love that advice. Another thing that we have to talk about is that the publishing landscape is fast shifting, right? From with self-publishing, there are digital platforms now and shrinking bookstores. What excites you and what concerns you about where literature is headed? Also, now there's ChatGPT, and people think they are writers because Chat is spewing out some amazing alliterations and rhymes and all of those. So what excites you and what concerns you about where literature is headed?
What excites me is that there are too many avenues now. You know, there are lots of untold stories because people were, all of us actually, were relying on the mainstream publishing, you know. So at the moment, the platforms that you mentioned help us to tell stories differently in a wider way, you know. So that excites me a lot, you know, because nowadays it's very rare to find a person saying, it's very easy to find a person saying, oh, I'm also a writer. And then you say, I haven't heard about it. No, I publish it with digitally, you know, which is very good as well.
Yeah.
So we'll never run out of market. So that's the other thing. And we'll never run out of stories.
Yes.
What is exciting me at the moment also is the fact that stories that we read from a paper are no longer isolated. So you look at different, you know, adaptations on TV, on radio, and in movies. You know, most of the stories are exactly taken from the paper. You look at one of my, I'm giving an example, one of my favorite, you know, films, Shawshank Redemption. It's a short story. You know, it came as a short story, for instance. You know, so there's a good element of adaptation. So short stories are no longer, as a writer, I'm no longer only concentrated on one, in one genre. I'm concentrated in different genres. And that helps a lot for me personally as well, because I'm learning from different other forms of storytelling, you know. It enriches me. So that's why when you ask earlier on, oh, Nick, you are also, what makes you happy? Is that, I said to you, I'm learning every day.
Yeah.
Because I'm not only learning one form of writing, you know, of telling a story. I'm learning other forms of telling a story. I was not so long, you know, involved. The good thing is that I'm also into film. For instance, I used to teach script writing.
Ah.
So when you combine that, you know, with my short stories and novels, you'll find the touch from every sector of writing.
Yes.
So that's what makes me happy about it, actually.
Yeah.
What I'm not sure, but I'm just a little bit concerned about is, it's a good thing what I'm going to say. It's not necessarily
okay.
a bad thing. The AI, you know, artificial intelligence, how we use it into our writing. I find that, nowadays, because I also teach or facilitate writing in different, in Berlin, in Switzerland and stuff, you know.
Oh,
I do facilitate, creative writing, yes. So you'll find that sometimes people have, people that you are teaching, or you are helping to, you are helping them to be writers. Sometimes they steal a lot from AI, you know. So it's only how do we make sure that that doesn't interfere with our creativity?
Yes.
Because at the moment it's easier for people to say, oh, AI, write me a story about a ghost story.
Yes.
Because there's a competition in Johannesburg where one can win 50,000. Write me that particular story.
Yes.
And AI writes a beautiful story, you know? So, but how do we, I'm not sure, that's what I'm saying. I'm just not sure how we can balance that, how we can really, how that, we can make that not to interfere with our our potential of telling stories.
Yes.
You know, as much as it's a good thing, we have to look into that. Like, for instance, the jobs of the editors, of translators, because translator as a, you know, as a profession that you have to go to the school for, you know. People nowadays just translate from AI. Oh, okay, somebody has written a book. Okay, let me try. They want me to submit a story in German. AI, translate this into German. You see such kind of things. So those are the challenges that we're facing. And, well, every time we have challenges, this is one of the challenges. And it doesn't mean that it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that it's something that I just don't know at the moment as to how can we balance this beautiful thing that we're having with already what we have at the moment, you know.
What you're saying resonates with me so deeply as well, because for all my life, I've written speeches, I've written songs, I've written so many things. And with AI, it's become so easy. But I always catch myself saying, you are more creative than you are letting on. Put the tool aside, think. And if you need refinement and retunement, then come into the tool. But don't let it don't let it lead your creative genius, because you've already got that in you.
I agree.
And you know, as you were speaking, I'm thinking, oh, so many exciting opportunities have opened up because you just chose to put pen to paper and write these stories. And there could be somebody out there who's also got the gift of writing and doesn't want to be a starving artist, as is the term that is used for a lot of creatives. What can you, how can you open their eyes to the many ways, the plethora of ways and avenues that are available from just something as simple as writing? I know in America what a lot of authors do, but these are business authors, and I'm in business as well, and that's, this is why I know this. They'll write a book, but not because the book is the end all be all. It's because they want to have spin-offs to launch courses and programs and retreats and, you know, conferences from this one tool. But you've just mentioned how you're doing facilitation work in all these other countries. You mentioned script writing and all of these things. So what are the ways that people can have their eyes open to the possibilities that are available to writers?
Actually, there's some, one thing that I can say is that the mistake that people normally do or make is that to think that once you have your work published, then you'll be rich or you'll be able to support yourself. So writing has got lots of opportunities. As I tell you, for instance, I'm also a journalist. I'm also an editor. You can be writing for, you know, TV production. You can write for scriptwriter for museums. You can write for, I did that as well, you know, writing for museums in different parts of South Africa. And then I write also for, I also do, I'm a journalist, for instance. I do also a travel journalist. So I do quite a lot of travel journalism, writing for the Guardian in the UK, to make an example, or Stranger's Guide in the US. And also here in Germany, I'm also asked by different magazines to do that. But it's not only that. I mean, a tool like AI, for instance, also need feeding.
You know? Yes.
So it's up to you to write about it. For instance, I know somebody who is, whose job is also to feed AI. Because AI doesn't have, it doesn't know that in South Africa we got our own English.
It doesn't have context. It doesn't know,
yeah, it doesn't know that in South Africa, when we talk about traffic lights, we don't have anything like
robots.
Traffic lights. We talk about robots. It doesn't, we don't have a speak easy in South Africa. No. We have a shebeen. You know? We don't have, we have a double up in South Africa, for instance. for a shorter distance, you know, we don't have a faucet. We have a I mean, the we don't have a faucet actually. So those are the things that actually we can use for AI to feed AI in the new era. So people that are feeding it and then being an AI that is South Africa specific. Mm. So that's a job in itself, you know, that people can look into. There are so many jobs. There's so many things that we can do, so many things that develop. I know people that work for Wikipedia. You know, so there are different kinds of things that you need your specific writing skills for. So those are the few opportunities that are there.
And maybe the point isn't to know the whole way, but just to be obedient to the first step of writing, right? Because 20 years ago, I'm pretty sure you had no idea something like AI would come up. The opportunities you are having now, there is no way you could have predicted or anyone could have told you that they would be possible. Yeah. And so the point perhaps is to just say yes to the thing that is calling you right now, and where it will lead, that is between you and God.
Exactly. You are very right.
Yeah.
You are very right. And there are so many things that needs to be. Don't look only into the mainstream kind of writing. Mm. Here in Berlin, for instance, I know people that are writers that are being called, for instance, by big companies or big restaurants to come in just to write a menu.
Imagine.
You know. Or maybe it's Orlando and whatever, you know, they want to describe their clothing and whatever.
Yeah.
Whichever companies.
Yeah.
They normally would like people that know the language. Mm. So it's and people that can write. Mm. So look out for different opportunities. Mm. Some of the opportunities are hidden, and some of the opportunities you are not aware that they require writing. So just keep on searching.
Now I'm just being nosy. Why have you chosen to settle in Berlin?
I came to Berlin in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
I had lots of residences before in Berlin.
Mm.
And then, of course, me and my partner lives here in Berlin.
Yeah.
So... yeah, but the most important thing is that I could not have chosen a very beautiful, a very conducive place for writing than Berlin.
Mm.
There are lots of, I'll give you an example. It's one of the places that the first time, I've seen that, graveyards can be used as libraries,
what?
You know. People carry their books, go to the graveyard benches and read.
Mm.
And then there are lights everywhere. Of course, I love South Africa and it will still be home.
Mm.
But there are lots of so many things happening, that I wouldn't, it's not conducive for writer. Like, for instance, I left when there was lots of load shedding.
Yebo.
So that disturbs a lot of my writing rhythm because I'm not a person that you find that you forgot to charge your phone, your laptop.
Mm.
The following day, there's no electricity for 2 days and then you're not writing on that particular day.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So, and one other thing I love, sometimes when you're writing is a process in itself.
Mm.
When you're walking, you are actually writing as well.
Mm.
Here you can walk at any time of the day, you know, and that inspires my stories because I always think about it. So those are the kind of things that I've found about a city that I love best. And more especially when you are, I write well about South Africa from away.
That's so interesting because that was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
Since you're no longer on the ground, are you writing different stories now? Are you writing things you're seeing and not necessarily things you know from back home?
Yeah, there are lots of things that will always remind you of home. Like, for instance, I just mentioned that I can walk at night,
yes.
You know? So imagine when you're walking at night, you always think about, that South Africa always comes back to you, you know, when you're walking at night. And say, at home I would be thinking of getting
lost. Of course.
Lost. Yeah, and sometimes the most funniest thing that I always do, there's a trend here of ladies, for instance, putting their phones on the back pocket, you know, while walking or inside the trains and stuff like that. And I look at myself and say,
yeah, that could never be me.
Yeah, sometimes you feel like asking the lady or whoever that your phone might fall.
Yes.
Don't put your phone, because they might pickpocket us.
Mm.
And by this, I'm not trying to exaggerate how Berlin is to say that there are no thieves.
Yeah.
There are thieves, but they are very few and very controlled.
Mm.
So that's what I like about it. You know, that's what I like about it. So
yeah.
I write. So many things remind me of South Africa, for instance, while I'm here. So the opposite of what I get here.
Yeah.
And then when people used to talk, people ask you about quality of life,
yes.
you know. So you'll never know about the quality of life until you are living it, you know. You will think like waking up and earning 50,000 per month is a quality of life. But I've realized that that's not enough since I'm living here.
Yeah.
When the train comes every 2 minutes on your station and you don't have to get wet, you know, when it's raining because the train is on time. That might be quality
of life.
You see.
Yeah.
The fact that you can walk by the river and then carrying a book and then lie down, that's quality of life.
Man.
So it gave me a new description of what quality of life means. So that's what I like about it. Yeah.
Oh, man. And I can imagine you write from a different place, a place of ease, a place of peace, a place of core memories, better. And I'm not saying that home is horrible, but like better memories that unlock. So everything that happens is becomes a trigger that doesn't just enhance your writing, but even your quality of life is enhanced. So it's just it's a great experience overall.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And most especially the fact that nowadays the idea of home has changed a lot, you know. So just remember before I'm just around my time, around in the 80s, if you want to connect with your family, you rather do that with a telephone, or you can do that with a letter, you know. Right now, sitting here, I can be in South Africa at any time because of social media.
Yes.
So you don't miss home that much. If you want to talk to anybody, you just put a video speaker, for instance, and then you see a person's face. So the idea of being nostalgic about home has changed. Your post, your algorithm is South Africa, but you're in Berlin.
Yeah.
So whatever is happening right now, I can tell you that there's a building burning in Jenniste, Home Affairs, people or whatever. And I can watch that immediately, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying, that and if I want to write a story, I can write it right away, you know? So you no longer, social media has made our lives very easy has made us, you know, even our storytelling to improve a lot because you just look into the, okay, what is it happening? What are the people saying? You know, what is the threat? You know, such kind of things.
Oh, man. And as we bring our conversation to a close, Mr. Expat, if you could write a letter to South Africa as if she were a person, what would you say to her today?
My emphasis, of course, will be on a lot of, it will concern too much of writing. It will concern, I would say that books, for instance, are the most important part of our lives. And I'm saying this because I compare it to here. Let me give you an example. I'm just giving you the content of what would be there. An example is that during COVID, for instance, in Germany.
Yes.
So things that everything else closed, but bookstores, not everything else, of course. Restaurants, restaurants closed, nightclub closed, and but books, bookstores, and also supermarkets
That's so
were
interesting.
considered the essential part of
Essential
people's life.
services.
Yeah, so they remained open because without books, people will go mad. The society might not be. So it really shows you the emphasis of this country, not only here, but different places. You walk around in around Berlin, around Germany, for instance, there are smaller libraries where people just drop a book, somebody else will pick. Library, small, like a small glass thing, like a fridge when you are from far, with books. So it's a smaller library. Anyone can, whether a person is homeless or whatever, needs a book. So you can open there and read the book and put it back again and or restock. And then those are the things that are essential. I come from, my home is in Soweto, for instance. And I'll tell you how much I've been visiting the library, for instance, in Shawelo and also in Orlando West, where I grew up. And I've never found even my book. You understand what I'm saying? So it's because our priorities into reading are not, we have to get our priorities right. And reading should be such a priority. That's where we always praise people outside and say, that one has managed to manufacture a car. It's because they've learned it from
They
that
learned
library on
it,
the street,
and it
you
was
know? So,
essential.
yeah, exactly. So imagine if we could have such kind of a society whereby you simply walk around your place at a corner there. There's a small glass and where people can take books. And I'm just glad that the library it's open, but I cannot praise the Department of Arts and Culture and the Sports that the library is open because it's an essential. It's an essential. So it's something that they should be doing. It's something that should not close at all, you know. So we need more libraries, for instance. We need the moment you put a book, a library out there, you encourage people to read. You encourage people to think. You encourage people to be entrepreneurs. You encourage people to be engineers, you know, different kind of things, you know. So at the moment, we all want to be DJs. We all want to be soccer players. Because we're streamed towards that, you know. So, those are the things that I would love to talk about. That look, there are so many things that we can do to improve our societies. Just imagine a person that you have seen walking around the city who is not working. Just imagine seeing them somewhere reading a book because a book is for free. They can get it for free. And I will encourage every library to stock South African books. You know,
Please.
what is the use of a German person coming to South Africa and they find books by German writers there? You know, they must get our books and then get to be known.
100%. Oh, Nick, you've reminded me through this conversation and even in your work that stories are not just for entertainment. What they are memory keepers. We emphasized this earlier that they are truth tellers. And you know, the more you read stories that resonate and relate to you, you realize how these stories can also become architects of empathy, because finally you get seen, you get heard, and possibly you find a way out of your own situation. You know, through your words, we are given the gift of seeing ourselves more clearly and seeing each other as well with softer eyes, because I think it's only when you start realizing what the other's going through that you can have grace. And you can stop judging them for the decisions that they are making that you would make as well if you were in your shoes. And I really think that the real magic of a storyteller like you isn't that you just write about people, but you write people into being. And for that, I am so, so grateful that you exist, that you live, and that you carry our townships. Because, Mina, I grew up in Jablan. You carry our townships in your chest. You put laughter and grief into ink, and you make sure that the world knows that South African stories, South Africa's stories, are not just alive, but they are unforgettable. Thank you for making us seen by the world.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad that we were able to talk, and I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Ah, this was lovely. Have a lovely, what time is it now in Berlin? I don't know, but have a
Well,
lovely day, evening.
so thank you so much. We share the same
Oh,
timeline,
fantastic.
so
Fantastic. Have a lovely
yeah.
day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye for me.
And that, my friends, was our shapeshifter for this week. I am Nompumelelo Mbonane, and I hope you have just made sense of your business. Fresh mercies tomorrow. Ciao for now.
Adventist World Radio, from broadcast to baptism, powered by SID Media.